You're listening to a podcast from 702.
This hour, we move on and we talk politics. Obviously, the most important political story of the day and of the week is the State of the Nation address. That's going to be delivered at 7 o'clock this evening by President Cyril Ramaphosa, his third one. And I have asked Karima Brown to join me in studio to talk about the State of the Nation address. And what we're going to do is the two things that I had mentioned at 9 o'clock are the aims of a State of the Nation address. One, to look back. Secondly, to look ahead. You look back and you audit the year that was. What did you promise? What did you achieve? How much progress are you making on those issues where the goals have not been, in terms of final outcomes, managed to come on board? And trying to make sense of why it is that you had failure where there was failure. And importantly, even where you had successes, why did things work when they did work? Because you need to be able to potentially learn lessons there. And that's very important auditing work about the state of the state. That's the first thing we're going to do. And then ahead of that, we're going to do speculative political analyses and have a look at what it is that the president might be saying in the context of an economy that is at its knees. The internal battles of the ANC factionally continue. Various parts of the state are improving from the Zuma years. Other parts of the state continue to battle to do so. And many of the thugs continue to hope that they can make a resurgence in terms of hollowing out the state. And that means that there's some really important speech craft as well as strategic political questions on the minds of the president. Karima Brown is, of course, a broadcaster with ENCA, where she hosts The Fix on a Sunday morning. Excellent and compulsory viewing, and a seasoned political editor, political reporter, journalist, and also producer in broadcasting over many years, and one of the best in the country. Karima, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Eusebius, and thank you for actually taking analysis seriously. You're devoting an hour to it. We have become so used to rendering very complex situations soundbite proof and ready. So, you know, kudos to you and your team for making the space for people to really engage.
I appreciate that, and I'm lucky that the format allows it. Long-form journalism, I think, is underrated when all of us have short attention spans in an age of digital where we want to read things in also small little bites and then move on to the next item. But I trust my listeners will stay with us for the entire hour. Please feel free, if you have questions for Karima, to call in on 011-883-0702. Some things are a matter of evidence, and then there are other aspects of political commentary and analysis where we can reasonably disagree. So as and when you want, the lines are open throughout. We will also take your calls, and you can engage with me as a political commentator and with Karima. So I'm going to wear two hats, as broadcaster and as a commentator myself. I want to start with the president in his own words, Abel. We've got clips from two consecutive years. We're going to start firstly with what he had said in 2018, then in 2019, and then we'll get on with the first big theme, which is to look back. Here is the president in 2018.
Many of our enterprises are experiencing severe financial operation and governance challenges. And this has impacted on the performance of the economy and has placed a great deal of pressure on the fiscus. We are going to intervene decisively to stabilize and revitalize state-owned enterprises. The recent action we have taken at Eskom to strengthen governance, root out corruption and restore the financial position is just the beginning of the processes that we are going to embark on. Government will take further measures to ensure state-owned enterprises fulfill their economic as well as their developmental mandates. We will need to confront the reality that the challenges at some of our SOEs are structural, that they do not have sufficient revenue streams to fund their own operations. These SOEs cannot borrow their way out of their financial difficulties, and we will therefore undertake a process of consultation with all stakeholders to review the funding model of our SOEs as well as other measures.
That's really, really, really interesting, right? Now, that's in 2018. There's a lot more, obviously, the president said, but I wanted you to just get a sense of the kind of theme that dominated back then. SOEs, changing the financial model, strengthening the governance of Eskom, rooting out corruption. That's a promise that was made not last year, the year before then. Now, here's a clip from 2019.
And it is time to make choices. Some of these choices may be difficult, and some of them may not please everyone. In an economy that is not growing at the level where we want it to grow, and at a time when public finances are limited, we will not be able to do everything at one time. As we enter this new administration, we will need to focus, and we want to focus on 7 priorities. Economic transformation and job creation is at the top of our priorities. Education, skills, and health is the second. Consolidating the social wage through reliable and quality basic services is another important priority. Special integration, human settlements, and improving local government is another important priority. Social cohesion and safe communities is a key priority as well. And building a capable and ethical and developmental state is an important priority too. And the last one is building a better Africa and a better world.
Okay, so what's fantastic about what the president has done is that there was clarity in terms of the objectives, which allow you and me to be able to come up with a spreadsheet and do a tick box exercise, yes, no. And then obviously the devil then is in the detail. We can take almost any one of these. We can pick whichever one you want to start with. I'll start with one of them, Karima. If we talk just about, say, for example, the 7 areas he outlined last year, okay, in case you missed it, social cohesion, safe communities, service delivery, a capable, ethical, developmental state, and also local government, and then mutterings about Africa regionally. Take one area that is close to your heart. Safe communities, for example. Our communities are not safer.
You know, Eusebius, the best way to answer your question is to go back to a quote of a thinker, an African revolutionary that I admire the most. And he says, and this is Amilcar Cabral, he says, always bear in mind that the people are not fighting for ideas, for things in anyone's head. They are fighting to win material benefits, to live better and in peace, to see their lives go forward, to guarantee the future of their children. And that is precisely what we're seeing here when we're looking back at the president's priorities, whether they are education, the state of the state, SOEs, job creation. We are still fighting over ideas of how to do this. And ideas are not unimportant, but we actually have to get on with the business of doing. So if we are to look back and evaluate, let me say the word that springs to mind is patchy delivery, as opposed to paralysis, because it's not as if nothing is being done. What is being done in any given sector is patchy, which means it's uneven. There isn't a commitment from everyone involved to act coherently on the matter. Let me give you an example. The biggest threat to our economy is Eskom. 3 days ago, the energy minister made a statement, or a few days ago at the mining in Durban, the energy minister made a statement about a new utility when the president and the social partners in Nedlac were actually talking about how to save the existing structure, which is Eskom, through, of course, leveraging pension funds, government employee pension funds, but also, private savings. So that already shows you that there is still a battle of ideas going on, underlined by the fact that there are divisions in the African National Congress, which we got to. So in terms of delivery on any of the pledges that the president made over the last 2 years or even over the last year, The report scorecard, in my view, is patchy for a number of reasons. The African National Congress is a house divided, and it's divided on the basis of ideas as well as patronage.
Okay, I think at a high level that is absolutely correct, right? But I want to stick with a couple of those areas and understand how the divided house of the ANC in turn undermines the ability of the state to deliver on the top line message from 2018 and the top line message of 2019. Already last year, we heard things that quite easily could be cut and paste and pasted onto this year's SONA. He said last year, for example, I'm quoting the president, the lesson is clear. For growth, we need a reliable and sustainable supply of electricity. That was true in 2018, true in 2019. It's going to be true this evening as well. In your understanding as an analyst, how do the machinations inside Luthuli House, the NEC, undermine that statement that I've just read out becoming reality?
One of the first things that we must accept is that there are very few people with actual governance experience. There's a lot of people with theoretical experience.
Sure.
But actual governance experience is a problem. And that's not to say that people aren't qualified on paper. There are lots of qualified people. And that's not to say that qualified people who are in the jobs are not stealing when they're in those positions, because we've seen that happen as well. But there is a deficit of qualified professionals that can be put into the public sector, like Eskom, which, by the way, we must remind people, are a monopoly in the way that Tiger Brands is a monopoly. So you have big monopolies in the public and private sector that have very few skilled individuals, if we're coming to the public sector. And that, for me, is one of the reasons why they cannot deliver, why these plans are wonderful in a meeting room when the papers are being signed and the media and the cameras are there. But the minute someone has to actually lift up the bonnet, put their hands in the engine that is South Africa, people don't know where to start. And we've seen that in various places. We've seen it in municipalities. Simple thing. How qualified is a municipal manager? Can that municipal manager read a balance sheet? When a new CEO comes in, I can't get to his surname now. He's going to kill me. Mark Barnes, the former post office head, always made this statement. He said when he came into the post office, the first thing he did was he took all the stakeholders, starting from the worker leaders, through a case of here's the books. This is the state, the financial state of this institution. Right? If you want to continue to work here, we have to get to point B. In order for us to do that, we need to see whether we can actually do it, given the money that we have in the kitty. Can we live above our means? And all of us run households, you see, because we rob Paul to pay Peter. And that is exactly what is happening in the country, because we don't actually have qualified people running institutions. And if they are qualified people and they're trying to do their jobs, they were hounded out during the state capture years.
But the political duty to get a grip on that lies with the government of the day and with the president as the executive. And what's your assessment looking back since 2018 to now of how he's getting on with doing that? What was really interesting to me about one of those six or seven areas of goal setting in the second clip that I played there is you will recall, of course, that even the language and the framing of aiming at a capable, ethical, developmental state, that was almost like identical what he said in his latest newsletter about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Remember when he articulated that idea? And so that newsletter in a sense was a footnote to last year's SONA. But then the question becomes precisely to your point about the gap between theorizing and praxis and behavior inside the state at the level now of the state machinery needs to now speak to that kind of theorizing. I can write position papers on a capable ethical state till the cows come home. But what we need is an actual capable state. What accounts for the gap between these slogans being repeated year after year, newsletter after newsletter, and the tardiness of getting the state to be fit for purpose?
Professionalizing our public service. That is the key here. If you look and you ask the Minister of Public Administration, who's responsible for the quality of the, or the health of the state, and we often forget that, that is, of course, Minister Mtunu, and we should actually get him to explain where the place is that we produce public servants from. Where is the, what, where are the institutions? If you like, look at places like France, like Britain, like the US, countries who have different types of civil services, some who are professionalized despite who's in government, others that are deeply political. So we even, you know, we don't even have to deal with the question of deployment, because deployment in some cases work because the people are actually capable. But we have a combination here. Yeah. We have deployment and we have people that are not capable, that are sent to run institutions that they don't have the first clue about. And we also don't have a long-term plan to actually train directors general, to train, you know, senior civil servants that need to run the institution. That's the first reason why we don't succeed. The second reason why we don't succeed is we don't have consequence management. When someone is caught doing something wrong, it takes an awfully long time for the state to actually introduce a series of consequences that will prevent that action from happening, root out the cancer, and also institute change management. So our ability to actually react. You take Life Isidimeni, you take the situation in Kwakwa, you take the situation in schools, for example, with pit latrines. I mean, it's a recurring issue because we don't actually have a place where people are held accountable. You can literally be a state official, be suspended for almost 2 years, in some cases even longer, if you take someone like Richard Mdluli, for example, who was head of crime intelligence, on full pay. Because you can drag the state through the court. So for me, it's the combination of no training and also no consequences.
Okay. So we don't have a coterie of public workers, civil servants, right? We don't have that, and we don't have accountability entrenched and consequent management.
And where we do have them, if they don't want to implement our illegal actions, we often get rid of them. That's what political heads do.
I want to talk about successes, if they exist at all in the state, in a minute. I just want to spend one last minute or two on the bad stuff, diagnostically speaking. I feel a little bit like a broken record on this. If one puts it positively, you will say institutional memory, now that I'm getting old, because these are conversations we keep having as political analyst broadcasters. When you had your show on 702, I mean, you've had this conversation, whether it be with Mark Swilling from Stellenbosch, whether it be the researchers from the Public Affairs Research Institute, precisely to this question of how do you build capability within the state? How do you engender consequence management? Or whether it be the Helen Suzman Foundation that comes on to have that conversation. Is there a possibility that in 3 years' time, whether a year or in whatever other capacity, you and I can simply play back the audio from today and the situation will be the same? Or is there reason to believe that actually there are pockets of excellence? And I'm going to give you an opportunity here to find a pocket of excellence in 3, 2, 1.
Well, you see, yes, I must first start with saying, do you know how many ministers actually contact me saying, I need a person. Please find me a person. And when they say that, they are exasperated because they often find departments depleted. Let's take, for example, Minister of Water and Sanitation, Lindiwe Sisulu. She inherited a department that was actually hollowed out completely. It had no top leadership. Plus, it was bankrupt. So much so that the former head of SCOPA, Tembo Gordy, said, Nomvula Makunyane should never, ever be employed because she rendered that department so completely useless. And, of course, a few months ago, Lindiwe Sisulu made a whole host of appointments, right?
Yeah, that's right.
One of the appointments that made sense to me was Mo Sheikh. And people will say, why are you saying Mo Sheikh? He's so controversial, etc. But he made sense for me because water isn't just a developmental issue, it's actually a security issue, right? To secure our water sources. And he is, during his time as the head of state security, he actually looked at water as a potential source of conflict and security. So that is one, for me, good appointment, where you're actually matching the problem, because the long-term problem isn't about just how we manage water, it's actually the security of our water services. Right. So you match then that strategic post with a committee that's going to look on that. So that for me is one indication of a solid post. Obviously, Mr. Sheikh will have to show and deliver, but that is a good indication. Now, let's take the same ministry. You have Patabile Dlamini, a former minister in the executive, responsible for chaos on a scale unimaginable with the most vulnerable in our society, the people who live off the social grants. Also hired in that same ministry around housing. Now, how do you account for that? The mismatch is so completely at odds with each other.
One foot forward, one two back.
Precisely. And this is what bedevils Cyril Ramaphosa's presidency. And not just Cyril Ramaphosa's presidency. Any presidency that allows the African National Congress as a governing party in its current state to forward a candidate to be the first citizen of South Africa.
Another case study for progress we would have hoped by now, but yeah, a point that you often make, not to defend the presidency, but to bring in realism, is of course a timeline for dealing with completely hollowed out institutions and organizations where you've had a loss of personnel that are excellent and therefore a loss of both skill as well as institutional knowledge and memory is the criminal justice system and specifically the NPA. By now, we would have liked to see many thieves in the docks, if not found guilty, because the cases will be complex and will take years. And Shamile Botori has now said publicly many a times that even though she knew she was in for a huge challenge, she couldn't have anticipated quite the enormity and the nature of what she's dealing with, to the point where she can't even be sure who to trust as an ally inside of the NPA. We don't have a crystal ball to know what would happen in a counterfactual, but I would venture to say that's one area where there was an excellent set of appointments at the top leadership position, and we probably would see a worse scenario in a scenario in which that appointment wasn't made, even if we're still waiting for results that look, in terms of perception, like magic is finally happening.
What a fantastic example to use, Eusebius. So here's the wins on the Shamile Botori appointment. Firstly, let's look at how she was appointed, because the president in South Africa has enormous power. Anyone who's the president, that person is appointed. The NDPP head is appointed by the president. Because it was abused previously in under President Jacob Zuma, Cyril Ramaphosa initiated reform and allowed a committee of people to appoint that person. So tick that box, as in we are on the road to reform and not abusing state institutions. Precisely.
Well.
Right. And also to depoliticize those institutions. We saw, for example, someone like Sean Abrams being at Lithuli House the day before former Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan was charged. So you give the president kudos for that, right? Shamile Botori is someone who has experience, so she's a qualified professional, the issue that we were lamenting before. Mm-hmm. You give him kudos for that. But now she comes to the institution. Now, what a lot of people don't know is that Shamile Botori can't appoint her deputies. The president has to do that. We had two deputies. We had the head of actual corruption, Mr. Mkhwebe, and we had Ms. Jiba, both of them implicated in state capture. So Shamile Botori came in and spent the first almost 3 months of being in charge of the NPA, dealing with two people who had eventually had to be removed from their positions by parliament nonetheless.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of time, you have a South African citizenry that says, when are people going to appear in the dock? When are people going to have orange overalls? Bishop Makgoba, the Archbishop of the Anglican Church, delivered a powerful message to Cyril Ramaphosa, and 30 organizations met yesterday to insist that this must be the year of orange overalls. But here's the catch, Eusebius. We cannot have Cyril Ramaphosa ordering arrests of people. We cannot have a president instructing the NPA who to arrest.
Yeah.
We cannot have a justice minister do that. Mm. We cannot have a police minister do that. We have to actually build the institutions, the walks, the NPA to do that. And for South Africans, that is very important to understand. They should never lose their impatience, but we shouldn't become anti-democratic in order to be unhappy or to satisfy ourselves that the speed with which we act satisfy our level of outrage.
And we can't get Shamila to be instructing her prosecutors what to do
Absolutely.
Internally. And in addition to that, we've had many examples like in Bloemfontein courts where you have egg on your face. If you take a case hastily for the sake of there is a baying for blood on the part of the public to court and you're not ready, then the Guptas will get some of the stolen goods back and fly out the next plane to wherever they go. So you also need to make sure you have your ducks in a row, that you have a winnable case by the time you actually get there.
Spot on.
Eusebius Makaiza on 702 for the curious.
27 minutes before 11 o'clock, you have heard for the last half an hour the incisive analysis of extremely experienced political journalist and analyst Karima Brown. Now it's your turn. Tell us how you are feeling about the state of the nation. The actual state of the nation are your direct experiences of this country we live in. And so in a sense, your individual experiences all put together constitute the state of the nation. Tell us how you feel in your communities where you are. How you feel about the high unemployment levels? What is that doing to you? Your levels of frustration? Are you, to go back to what the president mentioned last year, feeling social cohesion in South Africa? Are the communities you are in safe? What about service delivery? What about local government where you are living? And do you think that we have a capable, ethical, developmental state? And if you have any questions for me or Karima, call in, engage us, agree, disagree, underscore points that you think are important. The lines are open on 011-883-0702. Karima, let's do two things before we take our first call is Sean. The first is something that is particularly, I think, a strength of yours amongst the commentariat. Give us a sense of what the political constraints are in terms of how power is exercised by the president. He doesn't exercise power in a vacuum. Yes, he has got authority that inheres in the Constitution as a source of law that outlines his legal powers, but we have a party political system.
Yes, Eusebius. I mean, that is a plus and it is a minus in many ways. So in terms of it being a plus is that you have space for smaller political parties to actually function, because if we didn't have a party political system and just a first past the post, many of the voices, the independent voices that we hear in Parliament that raises the red flags when things go wrong, simply won't be there. So we need to be very careful when we criticize our political system. It does need reform, but you don't necessarily have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. On the other hand, given the fact that we don't elect our president directly, we are at the mercy of whichever party wins, the majority votes in the country. You can't ignore the African National Congress. And the African National Congress, as we've said on this show and many other platforms in conversation with each other, is not one thing. So currently, what must be remembered is that the African National Congress is going to a National General Council meeting in June, July sometime. And it is a very important meeting because it's the midterm review of the five-year presidency of Cyril Ramaphosa. And this is, of course, his first term. So the big question that most people ask you and I is, will Ramaphosa last, right? That's the question on everyone's mind. And are the moves that are being made as a result of people already looking past him? Richard Cullen, for example, whom both of us often chat with, believes that he needs to have a second term, but is afraid that his opposition in the African National Congress might grow and he won't serve out his term. So that is actually one of the biggest drivers of the way in which one must understand how the president is moving at the moment. Some of the things he can act a lot faster on, but it's pointless him acting if he leaves his base behind. And no president can ignore his own political party. Just ask Thabo Mbeki, okay? You pay the price for that. So Cyril Ramaphosa is hamstrung by the power balance, not just in the African National Congress, but also in its alliance. It is in alliance with COSATU and the SACP. And before people say the alliance is dead, the proposal on the table today to save ESCOM is coming from COSATU. And it is the first time that the Treasury is beginning to discuss an out-of-the-box approach to dealing with a state institution. So those who dismiss the alliance do so at their peril. The influence that they wield inside the decision-making structures of the African National Congress is very, very important. COSATU President Zingi Swalosi said on the Fix last week that she expects from the President very clear understandings of how investment funds are going to be harnessed to bail out Eskom, which of course, if not saved, will in fact derail the entire economy. So those are some of the factors that we need to take into consideration when we look at the speed with which Ramaphosa functions and also some of the decisions that he sometimes takes. They are not unimportant. In fact, they are fundamental to understanding properly what the President is doing at the moment.
Sean, good morning.
Hi.
Go ahead, sir.
Yes, sir. Just from my armchair analysis, and something that really matters a lot to me is the economy. And I see this every day as an entrepreneur and a mentor as well. Mm-hmm. I think there's a three-pronged approach that's kind of failing our economy. One, young people of any age or race cannot get money to start businesses. Mm. So we're not creating new employment within the country. The second issue, we still have this love affair, obsession, or thrill does with the corporate world, as if the corporate world's going to come save us. We need to realize that the corporate world doesn't care about South Africa. It only cares about itself and a few white male shareholders at the top that earn more in a day than most people earn in a year. And then the third kind of prong to this in our economy is that those who are employed within corporate barely make it month to month, and we see that by the rising debt levels. So there isn't even a way of us buying our way out of this trouble within the economy, because there is no spending power. And for years now, I haven't heard a solid plan to kind of address this and deal with it. And we see the closing of Mittal in Saldanha and the mines. It's just going to get worse. And there is no solid plan from Cyril. And I would say, in my opinion, the silver bullet or something that can just get the ball rolling is genuinely get money into young people, any people's hands, to start business and start employment there. This idea that corporates are our messiahs is going to keep us in this kind of predicament quagmire that we're in.
Beautifully put, Sean. Three brilliant points. Call it armchair, I call it compelling. I really have nothing to add there. Each one of those topics require full ventilation. But as themes, I don't think you're going to find disagreement between even Marxist Karima and Liberal Eusebius on each one of those. But let's just acknowledge them quickly before we take Tammy and Steve. Youth unemployment, it's very hard to exaggerate how critically important it is to get young people, A, to work, and those who have an entrepreneurial spirit to be able to go from concept to be able to take the concept eventually to a viable young small business that can also have a multiplier effect in terms of employing other young people in the communities where you come from. I'm scared, Karima. I'm really scared at the effect on the foundations of our democracy, not just of unemployment in general, but particularly youth unemployment.
Eusebius, we are right to be scared. Besides, this is consistent with a global phenomena, because, and also an African phenomena. We have over 200 million young people on the African continent. My problem isn't with the banks not wanting to give young people money. That needs to change. But this idea that a single person can by him or herself access finance and start a business and be successful and employ people is a myth. Mm. Many studies have shown that people who run startups, who are entrepreneurs, are often from wealthy families, because their families can actually absorb them. I want to talk about alternative forms of ownership. Why are we not putting cooperatives on the agenda? If you look at places like India, if you look at the state of Kerala in India, you have masses of poor people having a stake in the flour that is being milled, the grain that is being milled for the flour to make the chapatis. And those people have a stake, a direct ownership in that. We can't think by creating, the government had a ridiculous target of 100 industrialists. How is 100 industrialists going to change the fact that we have 10 million unemployed people, and within that 10 million, you know, the majority of them are young people. So we have to look at other forms of ownership. We have on a massive scale.
We then come up against his second point, right, which is about corporates. Again, yeah, sometimes corporates are very clever. They are a bit like right-wing political parties in Western Europe who appropriate the language of the left, but then really are smuggling in their regressive politics by pretending to care for left-wing outcomes. Corporates will talk about exactly the things that you've just mentioned, using, as you know, at the conferences you attend, language like stakeholder theory, stakeholder capitalism, economic democracy, or of course, the latest fad, shareholder value. That's important. But the proof is in the pudding, because you can go to the Sandton Convention Center, talk about the importance of value sharing, and then go back in the afternoon to a place where the workers don't have a stake in that chapati or whatever that's being made.
Absolutely, UCBS. It's sophistry. All these words exactly. that they use, it's just sophistry. If we don't have a corporate sector that needs to understand that it needs to come to the party, I mean, it is on an investment strike in many ways. The president has had two job summits, right? Raising billions of rands. But we have yet to see where that money is going to come from. We have yet to see the big corporates actually putting their monies where their mouths are. We look at, for example, the recent visit of the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. She came here to do something I think that was completely underreported. She came here to partner with South Africa on vocational training. Now, as you know, Germany is the poster child for vocational training. You tune out mechanics there. They are able to make things, they are able to manufacture things. Out of it, colleges are in a mess.
And they're valued socially, something we've spoken about
precisely.
Before. Social value and economic
exactly.
value.
Exactly. Not everyone has to go to WITS, and you're not less intelligent if you're going to a TVET college. But here's the thing. The TVET college must have a lecturer that is constantly being educated in the real world of work.
Sure.
And if you are at a TVET college, you need to be able to be placed with an institution, either in the private or public sector, so that you can put your skills to work.
Absolutely.
And that's where we have to get it right, UCBS.
Sean, we'll leave your third point, but suffice to say we agree with you, and I know Karima does, the way in which some people are stretched as workers, which is why we refer to the idea of the working poor, and something Karima often repeats is some people are so indigent, despite having jobs, they work to get to work. Marcel, good morning to you. Thank you so much for calling in.
Sorry, hi, Eusebius. I think you guys need to start talking about this fact that we're a one-party state, effectively. I think the ANC, together with its alliance partners, is so dominant at every committee in Parliament that all those voices that Karima says are being heard, there's no action taken ever, okay? So they're not accountable. None of them become accountable of the tripartite alliance. So now you want to professionalize the public service again, in a one-party situation, they're never going to become accountable to each other, because with professionalization also comes accountability. The whole issue from Zuma onwards has been no accountability. They are getting away with whatever they want to do at whatever time, and we continue. And so I believe the only healthy thing for this country is for the ANC to be disbanded, for the tripartite alliance to be collapsed. Because, you can't run this country as a one-party state.
Marcel, what we can't do, literally, is to disband the ANC. We did that. It was called apartheid. And then we unbanned them again. Hold on, Marcel. Take a deep breath and calm down. We're having a conversation. There are many conversations to be had. If you're a regular listener to this show, you know my mantra about democracy. Democracy requires competitive politics. Competitive politics require opposition parties that are viable and attractive to the people who are as pissed off with the ANC as you are. No one wants a one-party state. We don't have a one-party state. We have a democracy with a party that dominates. And the question is, why do they dominate despite underperforming? They dominate despite underperforming because the DA is useless, the EFF is useless, and the smaller parties do not know how to capitalize on Marcel being annoyed and Eusebius being annoyed and Karima being annoyed. So we can diss the ANC till the cows come home. The civil and political rights entrenched in the Constitution do not stop Herman Mashaba, John Steenhuisen, or Julius Malema from garnering more votes.
Yeah, no, I absolutely understand that. But until that comes home, the ANC will never self-correct. It's gone declined. It's doing what it wants. And that's the status. The status of the nation is a one-party state, effectively, because of the dominance of the ANC.
Yeah.
You know, you see, because I want to come in here. I mean, it's great that you have listeners that engage, but one is entitled to one's opinion, but what is, one is not entitled to one's own facts. This is not a one-party state, okay? And it's important factually for that to be noted. Secondly, the point that you made about the weak opposition, the ANC has the gift of weak opposition. We need to hold our entire political establishment responsible for this. We have to ask Julius Malema, why today, when you can demonstrate what you can do as an alternative, are you choosing to disrupt the state of the nation instead of telling us what you're offering us as South Africans? That is a question that we have to put to the third largest party in the country. I mean, it's easy to knock over a doll in H&M. You know, it's a lot harder to go and knock on Gogo Dlamini's house in Kofimvaba and say, vote for the EFF because of 1, 2, 3. Mm. And that is what is required from our political elite. They need to win the hearts and minds of the people. Stop coming onto the radio and saying that we are a one-party state when we have a functioning constitutional democracy that is young but functioning nonetheless. Ask all the political parties, what are you doing for me as, you know, Wendy, as John, as Eusebius, as Karima, as, you know, anybody. And I think that is the key issue. We can't outsource our responsibilities here. And we can't blame the African National Congress for being big and powerful. It is up
Karima,
to us.
I, as you know, I'm a harsh critic of the ANC. Which is why the likes of Jesse Duarte talk nonsense about me, because they hate the pointed questions I ask about them in government. But the truth of the matter is that despite the ANC being in a shambles, the DA couldn't even get 30% of the vote last year. Now the question is, who should be most embarrassed about the state of the state? The ANC or the DA? Quite frankly, both.
Eusebius MacIsa.
Eusebius MacIsa.
On 702.
Okay, Tulani, thanks so much for holding on. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Eusebius, how are you?
We're extremely well, Tulani. What do you want to ask or pine?
Just my 5 cents, Eusebius. I think I've been calling on your show for many years. I think the problem here in South Africa is not the ANC, it is not the EFF, not the DA. Because, one, they don't vote themselves. The people in this country, we have never come to a point where we understand what is the power of the people? I mean, democracy on its own, it is defined as the government of the people, by the people, for the people. Mm-hmm. However, the people in this country have decided to outsource what, I mean, their power to these political entities. When I understand maybe the way our constitution is structured election-wise, it makes us to vote for the parties, not necessarily the people that we want.
That's a very good point, Tulani. And during the break, Karima was putting it slightly more pointedly than you, but your complexity is appropriate, that sometimes we are reactionary in the way we respond to the party political system. And the reality is actually that we have recent memory, and in some parts of the country, still examples of civil society organizations that are deep and wide and embedded. And maybe we should, on another occasion, ask the question, how can we be reactivating our energies in those regards? Which is not to say, let power off the hook.
You see, be spot on. I mean, you know, my favorite refrain is don't outsource your power to big men and women in politics, right? Take your agency seriously, even if it is a party that you vote for. Let the African National Congress know if they put a list of candidates forward that are unacceptable, that they're going to pay where it matters. And we saw that in the municipal elections in 2016, in Johannesburg, in Tshwane. But we also have the benefit now of looking back from 2016 to 2018 and looking at the utter mess that is there, which comes back to the point that the DA has nothing to put on the table. The EFF has nothing to put on the table. And when we say that, we're not letting the ANC off the hook, but we have to talk about the entire political establishment in South Africa. And that is why citizens actually become important, and citizenship and active citizenship is not to be scoffed at. It is really, really important. We see it the world over. You can can take to the streets. You can hold your councillor accountable. You can hold your president accountable in various ways other than voting. We need to be the leadership that we require from President Ramaphosa. We need to be that in our homes, in our schools, in our businesses.
And when we recognize that, then we have to hold ourselves accountable for armchair criticism rather than getting our hands dirty. I want to get Zwelinzima Mavavi on the show. I'm intrigued by the latest attempt at a rhetorical level, whether it will translate into strategic cooperation we'll see in the next couple of weeks between him and other trade union movements and even COSATU as a renewed attempt amongst the unions to say, let's put our differences aside and let's see whether a pro-working class agenda can be brought to bear on the state on questions such as austerity, how SOEs are handled, for example. Now, the average person who's pissed off with the ANC who listens here, who is a working poor South African, then the question becomes, if Zweli or some other union tomorrow says, cool, march with me from Durban to Bloemfontein ahead of the budget speech, so that at a visceral level, the Minister of Finance can see we exist. What are you going to do?
Exactly. I mean, I think this is for me the big issue. And I think we must commend SAFTU for that initiative and all the trade unions that realize trade union leadership, despite their factional
huge
battles.
AMCU, SAFTU, yes, I mean, there's so much that divides them.
They have to come together. If we are going to make progress on a national minimum wage that will literally put cash in the hands of people who are not able to purchase a loaf of bread at the moment, then they have to get their house in order. They have an obligation to those who are employed to actually unite on critical issues such as basic rights for workers, extending those rights to workers that are not protected, and also the idea that you have to have a wage that is commensurate with being able to exist and live in this society.
Absolutely.
And I think unless the trade unions get their house in order, it's going to be very easy for corporate South Africa to actually knock them about.
I'm going to give you a full minute for the last question, even though it ideally requires more. We've been analyzing the material conditions of the land, the state of the state, the political constraints on the presidency and of government. At the end of the day, Karima, tonight is really about speech craft.
Yes.
Quite literally, it's an oratorical performance with words, right?
Yes.
Is there anything you can say that won't be trite? And how does it go about delivering that which is not trite? Just in a minute, what are you expecting at the level of sort of aesthetics and thematically?
Look, the president is who he is. So he is a consensus seeker. So I think what he needs to convey today is that there is agreement on what needs to be done, how it needs to be done. What he needs to tell us is when it's going to be done. And I think that he needs to do that with a combination of inspiration, because it's important to not be cynical. We are skeptical. And the difference is actually quite critical, because you can be so cynical that you go into a paralysis and you can then not see the complexities in society. But he needs to also be specific enough so that people can see how it's going to be done and when it's going to be done.
And for those into drinking games, you can have a shot of your favorite beverage every time he says robust.